Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for today's interview with Avi Steinman, who is CEO, founder, and director of Academic Language Experts. Tomorrow's a big day, because as of tomorrow, by decree of the Worldwide Federation of Scholars and Scientists in Stockholm, all research shall be published in North Germanic. The deliberation has been long and fraught, and much consideration has gone into deciding precisely which North Germanic dialect best suits the part of new medium of international scholarly and scientific publishing. Linguist favorites ranging from the conservative Norse of Icelandic all the way to the largest community of North Germanic speakers in Sweden, but ultimately the decision was for Bokmål, that variety of Norwegian which no one really speaks, but was judged and even compromised between the dialect extremes available. So tomorrow, the 15th of October, 2021, marks the day. It's in Bokmål, or else your research does not get heard. Okay, I'm joking, and you know that. This has not been some kind of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds moment on radio. Nonetheless, I hope I got you thinking, even if just for a second, about the arbitrariness of the language standards everywhere, and especially in scholarly and scientific publishing. Just imagine if you happen to be one of my American listeners, or in any case happen to be someone whose primary language is English, just imagine what this crazy Bokmål scenario would mean for you. Swat up on Bokmål, get your kids in Bokmål courses, young, extra hours on that book manuscript or on the article just to get the Bokmål right, and perhaps added cost to your research project for editing or translating services, never mind the added time to get this extra writing labor done. The majority of scholars and scientists across the globe do not have to imagine this scenario, because for the majority of scholars around the world, this scenario is reality. Their Bokmål is English. For very, very many people, language courses, language services, language worries, all this is part of their jobs. The systems and the markets to help scholars and scientists use English for their research purposes are everywhere. Universities have language instruction and writing centers. Book titles with the words academic and English appear year after year. And author services provide translating and editing assistance on projects ranging in size from the 200-word abstract to the 500-page book. There's a lot out there if your first language is not English, but the language of your research is English. A lot. But not all of it's the same. And that's partially a good thing, partially a bad thing. It's good because variety can offer people greater chances of finding what they need. It's bad, though, because certain standards of quality and integrity cannot be met if writing courses and translation services and communication training are being taught in any way by anybody for any reason. That is bad. Therefore, it's good when you find a standard among the educational institutes and private firms who work to help research make its way into English. The subject of today's interview, academic language experts, is one such standard. Authors everywhere who must publish in English find in academic language experts a service that brings expert translators and translator experts to the job of making research conceived and written in another language appear as research that was conceived and written in the Bokmål of today, the English language. And CEO, founder, and director of Academic Language Experts is Avi Steinman, my guest here today. So let's begin today's episode. Avi Steinman, Academic Language Experts. Avi, welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Wow, Daniel, that was quite the intro. I have to say, I don't think I've ever laughed so much during a... Had to hold myself back. Don't think I've ever laughed so much during an intro to myself. So I greatly appreciate, first of all, the invite to come on, but also, you know, the tongue-in-cheek humor that you're adding to this topic. I think on the one hand, it can be quite a painful topic for some scholars, especially scholars who are contending with this on an ongoing basis, but also a very important topic to contend with and to consider and to think through. And you've illustrated that in quite a clear way.
Well, thanks. That's great. And let's dive right into that aspect of it. So the larger area of English being the predominant language in very many areas of research, really the language in, say, the STEM fields. And I'd like to ask you, with your experience and your work in author services, what would you say is the reason that you see authors seeking out academic language experts for? And just to clarify that a bit, I mean by the reason, what is the perceived problem that they tend to come to you with? And maybe then what is also the real problem that academic language experts ends up helping them with?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I think you're right in saying that English is the lingua franca of academic publishing today's day and age. So, and there's a lot to consider if that's the way it should be or if not. I think that very obviously there is a value in having one language of communication so that in a particular field we can agree on terminology, we can agree on some of the basic foundational principles of how we are going to express and convey the research. And if everyone was doing it in their own language, I think it would turn into a Tower of Babel where no one would understand each other. So I think that everyone understands the value and the rationale of having one central language or maybe a handful of languages to publish in. That being said, it creates a number of problems and challenges along the way. The first challenge that I would, that I would consider is just the personal challenge on the individual level for a scholar for whom English is not their mother tongue. Maybe English is their second language, or maybe even third or fourth language. Academia, especially in the humanities and social sciences, requires us to really consider and be able to describe complex and sometimes intricate ideas in a very nuanced way. And when we are, and that's enough of a challenge to do in the language that we were raised in. If we're being asked to do that in another language, that can be extremely challenging and difficult. The second major issue that I see with, in almost exclusive publishing in English, and it's important to note that there are bilingual journals and there are books that come out in other languages, so it's not entirely exclusively in English, but the reason that predominant English can be an issue is that sometimes the research is actually very relevant to the local population, and publishing in English won't do as much good as it may do in the native language. So I'll give you one example just to drive this home. We were contacted by a scholar who was studying poverty among children in South America, and she was applying for funding in order to be able to translate her research into English. And I asked her a very simple question, which was, well, why aren't you publishing this in Spanish? And she said, you're right, I would like to, but I won't get credit or it won't be recognized to the same degree on my CV when I'm up for tenure as it would in English. And to her, that was actually quite the tragedy, because really the people she was helping needed this, or the decision makers needed this text in Spanish in order to do something with it. So I think that it's important when we're confronting this issue to understand the complexity, to understand the importance of having a central language to to, you know, kind of all be on the same page, but on the other hand, not entirely forget about what happens, you know, when we, what we're sacrificing when we're not publishing in multiple languages. And there are solutions, you know, there are times where we can publish in different in two different languages. And that, to me, in most cases, that can be seen as a positive thing. Back to your question in terms of how we help scholars. So the way I define it is quite simple. What we are trying to do at Academic Language Experts is simply level the playing field for non-native English speakers or for scholars for whom English is not their native language. And the reason that you know that's so important to us is because we believe that science is best served when everyone is judged based on the quality of the content of their material, of their study, of their research, and judged for that, and not based on the quality of the writing in English that they've taken on, or that they're capable of. In fact, in the literature, there's discussion about what's called linguistic bias, which means that reviewers, most likely unintentionally in most cases, will negatively look upon an article that has, let's say, non-standard English constructions in it, as opposed to a similar quality article from a scholar whose mother tongue is English. And therefore, I think that we need to be, you know, all of us in the academic community need to be aware of these issues, because for those who can afford our services, it's great. We're able to help them, but we're not able to help everybody. And I don't think that good scholarship and good research should be overlooked simply because of the scholar's ability to write in a language that's not their mother tongue.
And I'm glad that people are saying that, because I think that really matters, this idea of focusing on the quality of the research and separating it off from the language question. Nonetheless, it becomes quite interesting. I would say if we took the spectrum from the hard sciences, the STEM area, through the social sciences down into the humanities, it becomes very interesting probably to start to wonder, okay, where does the research actually decouple from the language, and where is the research very much the language? If we move over into the modern languages on the humanities side, essentially the research is text. So the text produced about the text is the research. We start to get into really difficult areas of, well, okay, what is the substance? What might be the substance? Or what might be questions of just mere accuracy? Are these concerns, notions, or thoughts that also occur to you and also your employees?
100%. And you know, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, Daniel, the medium is the message, right? And it depends on what field. I think that's mostly true in the humanities and social sciences, whereby even with our own students, we will dock their score, the score of their paper, if it's not written in a clear and coherent manner. So that's, I think everyone would see that as a legitimate action. The question becomes, what if it is clear? What if it is coherent? But what if it's just that it's written in non-standard English, or it's even chock full of grammar mistakes? Is that, you know, how do we handle that situation? On the one hand, I don't think anyone would accept, as serious a journal that's going to publish, articles that are full of mistakes. On the other hand, the question is in terms of the initial review, the initial decision of, should it even be passed on to review? Are we willing to, give a little bit more room for scholars to be able to write in a way that's comfortable for them, or maybe to write an abstract in their own language and then get it, and then have that reviewed. So I think this is, there's obviously the ideal, but then there's also the pragmatic. Journal staffs are usually quite small and sometimes rely heavily on volunteers and reviewers who are volunteers. So, asking them to jump through hoops is also not such a simple thing to do. So I think that it's you're right. The part of academia is also how we convey the messages that we're trying to convey. And I think that if we focus on high quality writing, regardless of the language, I think it'll do everyone a real service. Now, I'll tell you, we quite often face a dilemma in our own work, specifically with translating. And I'll clarify that our company provides translating services, editing services, formatting services. But specifically, I want to talk about translation for a second. Translation is a very delicate balance, because on the one hand, we want to honor and respect the authoritative source, which is the source text, right? That is our, even though we are creating a new text from nothing, we are using the source text as the basis for the construction of our translation, which I think is a basic requirement for a translator. However, that being said, no one wants to read a translation which is so literal that it can't be read in the target language. And therefore, the translator must, as part of their job, swap out some idioms that may not work appropriately in the target culture. They may need to rewrite sentences where the ending becomes the beginning and vice versa. And they really need to make a lot of judgment calls, meaning translation is just a series of judgment calls about how do I convey what the author is trying to say in a way which respects what they said, but also in a way that the target audience can understand, enjoy. And I think we've all had the experience, I don't know, Daniel, you'll tell me if you've had this before, whereby you've read a text and within a page you say, this is translated, right? We call it translatees. We sense it. We feel it. We realize that the sentence construction is not natural. I think everyone wants to avoid that. You know, there may be times where, you know, we're dealing with delicate primary sources where, you know, more literal is better. But I tell my staff, don't be literal. Use your creative license. The author will check us. The author will tell us if we've gone too far. But to me, I value the rendering of a quality text which still honors the source over a more literal rendition that may be more technically accurate, but loses some of the, you know, between the lines and some of the flavor. But that's up for debate. Not every translator agrees with that approach.
I really could only emphasize that I agree with the approach in the sense that it really recognizes the fact that a disciplinary discourse is not necessarily English. Now, let me just briefly unpack that and give it an example, actually. I was at a forum for writing studies in Eastern Europe. And found that the Slavic languages, in their own languages and in their own fields, have an entirely different academic style than we would expect in those fields in if they were in an English publication. To be very broad, the Slavic style is to save the important bits for the end. And by the end, I mean like kind of the last paragraph, right? An American mindset is no, the other way around, right? I mean, tell us up front what it is that you're doing or what your interpretation is, why this matters, what's the value of the research. So right there, you've got a massive translation problem. I mean, if you literally take one-to-one a Slavic text, let's say, in some Slavic language, you might be disadvantaging this author. They've got a great translation, literally, but is it going to serve their purposes for publication?
Yeah, that's a really great point, and I'll give you a few more examples. Japanese is a great example of this. In Japanese writing, and this is more of a culture or a educational style of writing and less having to do with the words or the vocabulary that's available, but Japanese academic writing tends to be two things. Number one is it's very repetitive, okay? So ideas are repeated in order to place emphasis on them, which is not something that you see in English writing as much. And secondly, you have a lot of Japanese texts whereby the writing is quite, I don't know if I'd want to call it passive or very suggestive, right? So if in a typical article in English, the author will write the study that, you know, whatever we found, in Japanese, they may write something along the lines of, our humble suggestion is or we think that, and that might come across as a lack of confidence to an English reader. Even if we're translating it accurately, the reviewer may say, well, they don't actually know, right? Because if they know, they would say they know, but that's not it. There's a level of humility that's a value there that doesn't exist that maybe, or, you know, for good or for bad, does not exist in the English writing. So then we have the question of, okay, well, we have a choice. Either we render it in a way which is, you know, which the English reviewer will appreciate and understand and know what to do with, but then betray the source text, or we, you know, honor the source text, but then maybe reduce the chances that the scholar is going to get accepted because it's non-standard. So these are really difficult questions. I think, you know, the answer is simple, and that is really open lines of communication with the author and laying out these issues, which is why, you know, when I speak to prospective clients, I tell them that, you know, getting the right academic translator or right academic editor is about a lot more than, you know, their vocabulary knowledge or their knowledge of the language. That's the basis. But you need to understand what academic writing is. You need to understand the specific field. And you also need to understand the cultural nuances and differences between different fields. Another example I'll give you is when we translate from Hebrew to English. So in Hebrew writing, there's a lot more in academia, there's a lot more of a focus on bringing in a lot of primary source texts. This is especially in the humanities, you know, in historical texts. There's a, you know, you can see a full page quote from a primary source. And almost inevitably, whenever I see reviewers going, you know, whenever we translate such texts and then it goes to review, the reviewers will say, you know, ditch half the source text, you know, like just, we don't need so much, you know, give us a reference, give us a citation, we'll go look it up ourselves. And so obviously we give our authors a heads up about that and tell them, you know, they should consider, even before they send us the text, they should consider these issues. But I think these are really complicated, you know, ethical and standard issues about, you know, how do we view our role as, you know, as author services or as you know, helpers? What should the credit be given? You know, that's another question, is what credit or what acknowledgement should be given to the translator and what, you know, how we look at their role. I once had a project fall through, a book project fall through, because the author, the translator, insisted that their name appear on the cover as translator, that they're given credit for, and the author refusing. And everything else worked out. We had the contract ready. We had everything sorted. And I think that, you know, I my sympathies are on both sides. I understand that the author spent years researching and authoring. The translator spends many, you know, much time reviewing and making sure their work is perfect and researching as well. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm not sure that everyone necessarily always understands the work that goes into proper professional translation. But this is just kind of a small window into that world, which I think is quite fascinating.
And there's two things that really jump out at me, and we'll try it. I'll state them right now. We'll try to pick them each up. The first is this idea that you've just greatly illustrated for us. You know, for instance, the Hebrew text with the large quotations of primary sources is just not done that way in English. So, I mean, we're dealing with not just different cultures, we're dealing with different modes of operations in the same disciplines in different cultures. I mean, this is fine-tuned stuff that you've got to keep in mind. And it's also present in English itself. It's entirely possible to have to translate from English to English. I mean, if you've got a molecular biologist who's trying to speak to the broader area of the life sciences, he or she is going to have to translate there hyper-expert knowledge into a broader sort of scientific English. I mean, all these sorts of translations are necessarily possible. That's the one topic. We'll just save that because I want to keep both the things in mind. You also make it so clear that author services are a integral part of the processes of research and publication, that we can't separate already out any more research from publication. I mean, they seamlessly go into one another, and clearly author services seamlessly belong in both of those as well. I mean, you've just said you've got translators who are also experts in those fields. I mean, this is all finely intertwined, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's interesting because I find that the worlds are small, meaning as large as our world is, when you get down into the nitty-gritty, really what we're trying to do, our goal is to find an expert in your specific field to be able to help you with your research. And what that means in practice is that oftentimes many of our translators and editors on our team are actually either academics themselves, so many of them are adjunct lecturers or they're emeritus professors who have retired but still want to stay involved. There may be postdocs who are looking for their first position but really have strong language skills. So you need a unique combination of someone with the requisite academic background who can really do, you know, really understands the material. If you don't understand the material, no matter how brilliant of a translator or editor you are, you'll either do one of two things. Either make a lot of mistakes because you'll have to take a lot of guesses, or you'll be very hesitant. And you see that, I see this a lot with editors who they retreat back to just making sort of cosmetic, what I would call cosmetic changes, as opposed to real deep, thoughtful changes, because they don't know the materials well enough, and they're scared, they're hesitant, because they say, well, I don't know if what this change that I'm recommending is good, so I'm just not going to make it at all. And I think that's something that we try to avoid by matching every project with an expert in the field, who, again, like I said, some of them are academics themselves, others are translators and editors who have done advanced degrees, sometimes even PhDs and postdocs in translation and editing studies, but are also closely connected to the work, to different, subject areas and different fields, so that they have the ability to really give intelligent and helpful feedback. Let's not forget that for many scholars, especially in humanities and social sciences, it's a very lonely process, and it can be very isolating to write an article. Or to write a book, for sure, and to do our research. And we're not always, we can't be our own editors. We can't catch all the mistakes that we're going to make. And over the course of a few hundred pages, we are going to write things that aren't clear. And we are going to, miss out, have logical gaps whereby we can't really tell the forest from the trees and understand where we need to fill in, or where we've given too much information or repeated ourselves. So one of the things that translators and editors that really are professionals and do a good job, one of the things they'll help you with is really being able to work with you to point out some of those logical inconsistencies. I've had plenty of cases where we have translators who even will point out factual errors and ask the, obviously we always couch it in, maybe you should consider checking this again. Obviously we respect the authority and the expertise of the scholar, but it's always good to have another set of eyes, and it's always good to have someone who's intelligent. I like to say that you could have 10 editors, and if each of them is an intelligent, intellectual person, they will be able to improve a text in some way. And obviously at a certain point you have to say, okay, enough is enough, and we have to send it off for publication, right? Can't edit forever. But I think the revisions process is really a critical process should be seen as part and parcel of the publication process. And I think that what happened was is that it used to be the publishers would do this more. And I think that the need for author services or for scholars to procure their own author services was less acute. And what's happened over the last few years, due to all sorts of shifts in the publishing world, is that they are offloading anything that's not essential to their work, or they're outsourcing it, or they're just turning around to the scholars and saying, this is your responsibility. It's very rare to find a publisher that will pay for a translation or editing. It's very rare to find a publisher that will do, some of the work that used to be done in order to prepare a manuscript for publication. So I think that all of a sudden made the need for external services such as ours a lot more relevant in a short time frame.
And I just can wholeheartedly agree with you on the ideas that you say about revision. I mentor scientists at the University of Heidelberg, as my listeners will know, and we'll go over a text over a number of weeks, yeah, of course, and it will be, week 6, 7, and I'll revamp another paragraph, and I'll often get the feedback. 90% of that was your ideas, and I'm like, we got to keep editing.
Yeah.
I mean, it, just to speak to this idea that the editing could literally go on forever, or that it's not. And I'm not a scientist. It's not something that the author, him or herself, necessarily is in the best position to do. I mean, one of the sort of foundation stones of writing studies is that it must be done through talk, which is, taken up in the tutoring form, the mentoring form, whatever it might be.
I'm glad you're raising that, because I want to say there is a dark side to there's a challenging part to our work. And I'll try and illustrate that through one example. We had a hospital that approached us, the optometry department approached us to help them with editing their papers. They were struggling with publishing in leading journals, and they approached us to help them. And we came to an agreement. And what ended up happening was we got so involved, and our edits were so thorough and deep, that when the reviewer came back with content-related questions and issues, the authors turned around to us and said, okay, you're our co-author now. Go fix this up and come back to us. And I had to, hit the brakes and say, you know what? We were so involved in the process, and I'm curious, Daniel, if you've ever had this, that it's important not to become a crutch. We want to be a lifeboat or a helper or a helping hand, but not a crutch. Not a service whereby, because, you know, let's ask maybe a difficult question, Daniel, for the work that you and I do. What is the difference between what we do and the services online that will write your papers for you, right? So I think me and you have a very clear answer to that, and that is we are not writing anything from scratch, and we're very careful about ethical questions that have to do with writing for scholars. But when a scholar comes in and needs serious help and serious, you know, revisions, so there does become a gray area point where you ask yourself, okay, at what point am I taking over? So we're very careful. What we've done, and this is the way that we've solved it, and I'm curious to hear how you do it at the Writing Center, is that for scholars who we identify need more than just a language edit, really need, you know, someone to dig down deep, we've turned it more into an academic coaching sort of service where basically scholars can come to us and we will match them with an expert in their field who will have weekly meetings with them where they will go over certain sections and give them suggestions and ideas, but not actually implement those changes themselves on every paragraph. Rather, make sure the academic does it and then go over and give suggestions and input. Because I think it's really important. You know, scholars are under a lot of pressure. I hope it doesn't come off as me pointing a finger at scholars. I think that scholars are under a lot of pressure to publish a lot very fast. You know, you won't get a it's like, you know, your advisor will tell you not to write any articles before you publish your dissertation. But then if you don't write any articles, you're not going to get a job. So then where are you left? You kind of have to figure it out. So I think people have a temptation to use shortcuts. And I think that that's the gray, you know, it's important to understand that there is no expectation that you can do this by yourself. No one teaches how to publish in an organized way. I mean, I've started giving, you know, webinars on it, but I haven't seen anyone who's really taught this or any universities taught this in an organized and you know, done well, on the one hand, and on the other. So, you know, people kind of have to learn from getting burnt and their own experience. And on the flip side, you know, so I can understand a scholar who would want help. I mean, you know, everyone needs help at one point or another with their research. Everyone needs another pair of eyes. I mean, I send my own work, my non-academic work, I send out to editing in English, and I'm mother tongue English. So I think it's important to make sure that line in the sand is clearly defined before we, you know, start out.
Yeah, this reminds me of a survey that you conducted where you asked people in listservs and also amongst your clients about how they perceive the situation with English being the predominant language and what sorts of troubles did they have. And a loud response came that scholars are reporting back a lack of resources for editing assistance, whether that be in the area, as you've just mentioned, at universities where you actually learn these things next to your science, for example, or afterwards when you're actually out there in the field researching and need to publish. Just to quickly sort of parallel your academic coaching to what I do in mentoring, they are very parallel. That is my approach. My instinct and my preparation for my instinct is to take a text and to fix it. I mean, that's like, you know, it was once said of James Joyce, who many will know, who wrote Ulysses, an impossible book to understand. It's like a map of Dublin. And his father once said of him that if you dropped down my son James in the Sahara, the first thing he would do would be to make a map. Yeah. So apparently he had this very geographical mind. My mind is sentence. You know, I just like to fix sentences. But this isn't necessary. This is very often not a good thing, right? You don't want to be approaching somebody who is either struggling on any level, be it the content level, the communication level, the grammar level. There's a million different levels inside of a text, and offer them finished products. They don't know how to get to that finished product, right? And my finished product might not be the finished product that they want. My goal at the writing program here is to allow people to write as they need to and as they want to. So that is a long process. It is a coaching process. Much as you've just said, it's a standing back and allowing people to become aware of what their options are as they go and write.
Yeah. So you mentioned the report that we put together, and I'm happy to share a link to that for anyone who's interested in reading it further. I think there's one word that sort of sums up the findings that we had when we spoke to scholars about their experiences. And again, these are scholars for whom English is at least their second language, if not their third or fourth, but are actively trying to publish in English. And that word is frustration. There's just a lot of frustration. And I think, I think the frustration is obvious. I think it's like we said before, it's difficult enough to publish. And it's even more difficult when you're writing in a language that's not, you know, not your comfort zone. And we came up with, and there are a few things that I think institutions, funders, journals can be doing in order to improve the situation. And if it's okay, I want to go through them. Number one is, I think that what you're doing and writing centers are critical, because in the end of the day, as important as the service and as valuable as the services we give are, it's my hope that authors aren't just taking our edits and just passing them along to the journal, but are actually learning from them. So I think if you have the opportunity to actually teach writing and English in an organized way via university seminar, I think that's ideal. I don't think it's being done enough. I don't think it's being done well enough in different places. And I think that can definitely be improved. So that's number one. Number two is funding for services, for author services, is really important. And for those who don't know, some of the European grants, Horizon and ERC, you can actually request as part of your funding translation or editing. That's a line in your funding. So don't forget that when you're going for funding, include that, because you don't want to come along a couple years later when you've used up your funding and say, oh, how are we going to edit our article? Well, I guess we won't be able to, and we'll have to send it in as is. That's not ideal. So keep it in mind. Funders are expecting it. So include it. I don't think it's an exaggerated request. I think university departments need to dedicate a certain stipend to every scholar every month or every year, let's say, for a certain amount of publication, and to help them along that process so that they can make use of services. And last but not least, I think one of the big frustrations that scholars feel is that they get burned by poor translation editing services all the time. And I think the reason for that is because as opposed to almost any other profession, you don't actually need any qualifications to call yourself an academic translator or an academic editor. You can just hang out a shingle and put your name on a website, and that's it. You're done. You wouldn't be able to do that if you were a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer or any other profession, but you can if you're a translator editor. So I think scholars would do well with taking the time, and sometimes, and that means that they can ask for a quick sample before they start the project. That's one way of doing it. It means seeing what projects scholars have, these translators or editors have done before. You don't want to be a guinea pig. You don't want to be their first time working on a project in history, or their first time working on from this language set. Or, you want to ask them for their credentials, see what articles they published in which places, look at their work, and see, do I think this matches what I need? Do I think that it's really going to be valuable? And I would approximate, I don't have exact numbers on this, I would approximate probably between 20 and 25% of my initial calls that I receive for work to be done are people who have gotten burnt and said, listen, I tried a cheap option. I tried something, I found someone online and just, it was a disaster. Sometimes it makes it even worse. So I think that, cheap can be expensive when we're not, if we're not taking things seriously. And it's important to really do the homework and do the research and find out who it is that we're working with before we get started.
I think that's fantastic. The idea that, this standard and the advice you give is really going to be gold for so many people listening. I mean, this idea that, yes, include money for services when you apply for your grant. Keep in mind how it is that you then find your author services. Think of academic language experts. Clearly, we're dealing with somebody here who is open-minded and considering the entire area of publication and research, not just out there to get clients and so on. I mean, that's made entirely clear in that. In fact, to follow that up, I would like to pursue just a little bit more this idea of where author services find themselves, because I think about this a lot when it comes to mentoring and training as well. And clearly some of our areas overlap when we think of the academic coaching, where they situate in the entire process, research, publication, and so on. Is there room there for collaboration with labs, publishers, or universities from your side?
Yeah, that's a great question. I call us the glue, to be honest, because you asked about research and publication, and I see us as the glue that connects those two pieces together. And why do I say that? Because you generally, scholars will come to us for help after they finish their research or after they've written at least the initial draft of their research and before they're going to send off for publication. So we can be that connector to the point where we have made a very a big effort over the last few years to build a network of relationships with publishers so that when a scholar comes to us and says, okay, I've got this manuscript, I want help editing it. And then afterwards, where should I send it? Right? That's a question I get all the time. And sometimes I chuckle because, especially when it comes to journals, because it's like, well, there's a couple hundred thousand journals floating out there in the world. I'm not sure can tell you exactly which one. But oftentimes we actually are in a position to make some sort of connection to introduce you to someone who can help from the publishing side. And I don't think publishers are trying to be distant or cold, but I think that sometimes authors can perceive that it's publishers, I have to fill out a form, I don't know who I'm dealing with, I might not get an answer right away. And I think that trying to humanize and personalize that connection is part of how I have seen, I guess, the evolution of our business. I'm not sure that I would have seen it that way in day one, but now I understand that to be a critical part. And as we grow from what would typically be known as a business to business, right? Meaning we're helping individual scholars. We've really pivoted. And in addition, not at the expense of, but in addition to helping individual scholars, we are working more and more with institutions to try and help both on the institutional side. So universities, colleges, think tanks, research institutes, to help them better understand the publishing process, get their texts into the shape where they can be ready. So for example, we have a book proposal review service that we offer, whereby we will take your book proposal, we'll review it, we'll give you suggestions and for how to polish it, how to improve it, how to make it better before you get ready to submit it to the publisher. And then on the publisher side, when we do have a good piece of research that comes through, we will try and to the best extent that we can connect it with the publisher that we think is most appropriate for the particular manuscript that's coming in, because it is a global world and not all scholars know about all publishers, not all publishers know about all scholars, and it's important to have those connections. So I think that author services, on a very basic level, it's a language, you can see it as a language service. I see it as much more than that. I see it as the bridge to connect between the author and their work and the ultimate goal, which is publication. And I want to talk about that goal just for a minute, if it's okay. I think that there are two things that happen simultaneously anytime we want to publish our research. First and foremost, the reason that most of us have gone into academia in the first place is because we believe in the field that we're working in. We believe in the topic. We think it's important. We enjoy it. And in order for it to have an impact, we really need to get it out there. And in order for it to get it out there, we really need to know how to publish. Those are the rules of the game, at least for now. There are preprints, there are other ways to get our research out there, but it's still the typical way of doing things. So that's number one. But number two is on a much more pragmatic, practical level. In most colleges and universities that I work with, publication is put on a higher pedestal than teaching or than administrative responsibilities. Publishing is the end all be all. I mean, I think it's very heavily influences the rankings that come out every year. I'm not here to say that's necessarily a good thing. I think it's worth having a discussion about whether that's the way to go. But so long as it is, it's important for scholars to continue pursuing. And one more thing I want to say, because I really think this is important. I don't think most scholars realize what percentage of scholarship is or submissions are rejected. I mean, in many fields, especially if you're talking about the top journals, you're talking about 80, 90, 95% rejection rates. And sometimes scholars lose confidence when they try and submit and they don't get it through. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. There's nothing wrong with getting another set of eyes to look over it. And also be aware that it's a long haul. It's a long process and you need to be patient. And rejection is part of the process. And hopefully, if you're lucky, the rejection will come along with some reviews that are constructive and positive and enable you to improve. And in the end of the day, I think we're all happy if we're able to revise and have a better article as a result of the review process. But I am the first to understand that it's really frustrating and can get people down. So, I think that's also something that I've learned over the years is that there's more to this than just technical grammar, what's right and what's wrong. There's an emotional component. There's a, you know, learning a certain level of patience. I always talk about having a cyclical view or a wholesome view of the publishing process. I think that every scholar should have the following, and it doesn't need to be exact, but some sort of concept of one article that they're in their mind that they haven't started working on it that they'd love to work on. One piece of research, one study that they're in the middle of. They're in the middle of completing their research. They're in the middle of studying it. They're working on it as hard as possible. One article that's with a translator or an editor or, you know, that's being worked on by some external professional, and one article that's in review with the journal. And I think if we always have that healthy cycle of, and it doesn't need to be articles, it doesn't need to be that exact cycle, but if we have that approach of we're not putting all of our marbles in, you know, we're not putting all of our, hope into one paper, but rather we're spreading ourselves out, we're continuing this and having a healthy balance between the different things that we're writing and moving from project to project, then if we do get rejected, well, we've got something else, or we've got a new journal to send to, or we've got a backup plan, and it doesn't become a situation whereby we fear even the act of submission itself, because I found that that happens with too many scholars, and it's unfortunate. I get it. I understand it. It's no one likes getting rejected, but I think it's important to understand that more people feel that way than you might think.
And you've just given us a from your own experience and from your thinking about this, a wonderful whole view of the publishing process, of the teaching process, most scholars obviously coming from universities, of the researching process, and also of the human side of it all, that there's a person involved in that who doesn't want to be rejected, who sees that as a failure and has to deal with that challenge the next time that they go out with another manuscript and think about, okay, am I going to try this one or not? It just makes entirely clear that author services, training programs, the research lab, the whole line of it is one working unit. And it's important for everyone to see that all of these parts are, in essence, equally important. If I might, I'll just refer very quickly to an interview I've had here, a book that's open access online, Reading Peer Review. You brought up the whole process of peer review. There's another one of these components in there. And the research that they did in this book, Reading Peer Review, was just really unique because they had such a huge cache of data from PLOS One of peer reviews, the reports, which are not things that are normally accessible. And they were able to analyze these and see what is it that reviewers are actually looking into. And of course, they're looking into all of the subject matter knowledge issues, how was the literature dealt with, the methodology issues, whether things have been omitted. They are. Expression was a major category, the language itself. And here, I'll just quote just this one sentence because it summarizes some of their findings in the area of language, and it speaks directly to what we're talking about now. I quote, "Clearly, though, it is also a mistake to regard the scholarly communications workflow as a steady, linear progression from peer review through copy editing into typesetting before proofing and publication. This is a wrapped up process. Everyone is doing a little bit of everything. The researchers are doing a bit of their own editing. They're turning to other people for editing. They're picking up research issues, the people in the publication, and so on and so forth. It just is all one mix, and we need to see that, and we need to also cooperate on it, I would say.
100%. I definitely see, I mean, in my experience, I definitely see a lot of peer reviews, and there's no question that language or clarity of expression is a big part of that. And I think that we have to be, you know, I get a lot of scholars who, you know, I speak to and say, well, you know, my English isn't perfect, or, you know, my writing isn't perfect, but it's good enough and I'll send it in, you know, as is. And I totally, I get it. I sympathize with that. And, you know, no one wants, especially if you don't have a budget for paying for these services, it can get quite costly. But I do want to make clear that I think that there are many journals and many publishers, no, not many, I'm going to say all, that are overworked and understaffed. And as a result, what they need to do in order to make a determination of which research to accept and which not to accept is they sometimes need to use what I would call either superficial, criteria or aesthetic criteria, such as and I'm not trying to say that language is just aesthetic. I think language can be an inherent part of the quality of the article. But I also think that sometimes just whether the article has mistakes or does not have mistakes can be a criteria by which reviewers will make a determination, or even desk, even before it gets to review, even the desk editor will make a decision and say, you know what, we're not even going to bother because this is not, edited or it doesn't read with the same clarity. And what I always tell scholars is that, so first of all, we want to be aware of that so that we're competing and we're actually getting, read properly. I mean, there was a study that came out that showed that most reviewers are only reading the title and the abstract and then moving on, which that itself tells us something about what we should focus on when it comes to our own writing and how much time we spend on the abstract. Sometimes I get people to write an abstract, 5 minutes before they submit, and I think that's a huge mistake. So I think it's really important. But the way that I explain it when I'm speaking to to prospective clients is I tell them our goal is very simple. We want the reviewer to be critiquing the quality of your research and not the quality of your writing, or not the ease of expression by which you convey yourself. And this gets into studying the brain. It's nearly impossible for us to try and decipher what is being written and consider the ideas themselves simultaneously. I'm not a brain scholar, but I would imagine that we're using different parts of our brain when we do those things. And if the reviewer needs to dedicate too much brain power to trying to decipher what in the world you're trying to say to begin with, and this can be both because of language issues, but also even if you have pristine language, but you're just not writing in a clear and coherent manner, can really have a detrimental effect on how the reviewers perceive your research. And therefore, it's critical for the writing to be top-notch so that you really are guaranteed for yourself that the reviewers are looking and judging the content and the ideas inside of your study and not the what I would call the wrapping or the externals that may get in the way.
I have to jump in there, and I wholeheartedly agree and think that this is also an interesting idea that you talk about the parts of the brain. I would even separate them out and say, this is going to sound a bit paradoxical, I'm going to say that communication is not language. And this brings me around back to that first question I was asking about perceived problems from your clients and the actual problems that maybe your experts are discovering. This point that you make where trying to pick out from the ideas what it is that the reader is going to understand from them, so let's just call that, say, coherence in the text, is not the same as correcting the language so that it's what we might call proper English. I mean, these things are worlds apart, aren't they? I mean, what you're doing is communicative streamlining far more than it is English correction.
100%. And it's important for me to clarify that we try and mark our services in a clear way so that those who only want us, not every scholar wants us to necessarily, get our hands dirty and really dig into the structure. So we try and structure our services in a way whereby those who do want it and do are self-aware and know they need some help with sort of that dirty work can do that. And also those who just want a language review can get that. But even that is not always such a clear line, to be able to mark in the sand and say, this is this and this and that. It's funny because when I get an email and they say they want editing or they want proofreading, my first question to them back is, well, how do you define editing? How do you define proofreading? Editing could be developmental editing, where I'm really looking at the whole body of work and seeing, should we be moving chapters around and restructuring ideas and bringing in new concepts that aren't there and removing things that are, and, kind of taking a sledgehammer and just, chopping away. And then there are those that editing, really all they need is just a proofread to make sure that commas are in place and that everything is sound because their writing is already so brilliant, and we wouldn't want to harm it. So it's really, I mean, obviously from experience, most people that we're working with, because English is not their native, English is their second language, need more serious help. But that being said, I think that it's really important to be able to have a clear definition of terms, which I'm not sure is necessarily out there, before you start working with an author services provider, to make sure that you're going to end up receiving what you want. So on the one hand, it's not too much, because there can be cases of over editing. There is such a thing. In fact, one of the things that came up in our survey that we did was that some ESL scholars get frustrated because they feel like the reviewers or the editors are over editing their work. But on the other hand, if something needs a real, serious edit, that it's not just getting a cosmetic touch up.
It really warms my heart to hear an editor speaking with people with whom they're going to work and trying to define what proofreading is. Yeah. I mean, that's one of those words that's just thrown around as if everyone knew what it was. I think if you cornered pretty much anyone from the modern languages department all the way over to the biology labs, you'd get 100 different answers. And I think that's also a sign of the sort of service that you offer, that you take these things seriously. And speaking of which, we've stayed on, you've given us multiple examples of how you help clients, and we've probably stayed on a rather abstract level. I'd be quite interested, though, to hear a bit about your digital presence, your blog, and perhaps also the live interviews, which I've seen on your page, and maybe just some of your day-to-day. What goes on for you as the CEO of Academic Language Experts?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that my wife would probably also want to know what I do, with my day and how that's structured. And one of the fun parts about, kind of being an entrepreneur and starting my own business in this field is that every day, can bring its own new excitement and challenges. But what I would say is, so first of all, in terms of my own, my own work, I'm focused pretty strongly now on building institutional ties and building partnerships with research authorities, with university publishers, with think tanks and research institutes to really, like I said, sort of transform how they publish on an institutional level, not just on a personal level. Again, we haven't forgotten I'm very lucky and thankful that I have a wonderful and dedicated staff, and they help every single scholar as if it's our only project. In fact, if you go on our website, you'll notice that there are no big buildings, there are no big skyscrapers. It's all about individual service and individual touch and presence and having a real support structure to help you. But my focus is working with institutions to really help them improve their research and improve their writing. In terms of some of the other things that we have going on, yeah. So thanks so much for asking. First of all, definitely we will leave in the show notes. Definitely encourage everyone to check out our blog. There's a lot of, we have both a blog and author resources. The blog is more sort of interesting articles that would be relevant for academics. The author services are more like practical tools. So you'll find there how to find the right journal for your research, how to follow up with a reviewer after you've gotten a review that you don't know what to do with. You'll also find a guidebook on how to prepare a strong proposal for a book publisher. So all these things are free of charge on our blog. Please check in. The other thing that you mentioned is we do monthly interviews. I interview. This is actually fun, I have to say, Daniel. This has been a lot of fun because I am usually in your seat. So we've traded seats where I interview leaders in the publishing industry about their work and about what it's like to publish a book, to publish a journal article. How do you make sure that your book can appeal to a popular audience? What does open access mean, and how does that work? And all sorts of interesting and fascinating topics. And these are, again, all free of charge. All you need to do is register once a month. And that's also on our website. We'll leave in the show notes. It's called the Publication Success Interview Series with Avi Stamen. So if you look that up, you should be able to find it. That's, again, Publication Success Interview Series. So yeah, I'm doing a lot of these interviews. I'm having a blast doing them because I really get to speak to what's been incredible, Daniel, is that, people I never would have thought would open their doors. People, real leaders in the publishing industry, have just been super gracious with their time and joined us, and we've gotten great crowds out. And you know what the best part is, Daniel? I have to say, is just the representation from so many different countries that we have. And maybe this like brings things full circle about your example at the beginning about, you know, rare German dialects and what if that was the real, you know, what if we all had to publish that way? And one of the fun parts about this interview series that I've been doing is that people have really been showing up from everywhere, and participating and being active and joined us and being in touch afterwards. And I think it really just kind of, that's one of the nice parts about Zoom is that it levels the playing field and enables anyone to be able to participate. You know, if before you to go to a conference to get knowledge, you'd have to go to a conference and pay a lot of money for a hotel and fly out there. Now, you know, you need a computer, you need internet, and you can log on and participate. So, they're all free. They'll always be free. And I invite you to come and check that out.
I can only recommend them. I've looked through many of them. They're great. They if you like this show, there's a crossover there as well. I mean, I'm all about getting out into the open about these things, transparency. Let's talk to the publishers. Let's talk to the editors. Let's talk to the scholars. And Avi is doing fantastic work there. So yes, it will be linked below the podcast here. Avi, you've been really generous with your time. I would like to send us off, though, with one last question. And we've heard so much about what clients get at your services, so many of the interesting aspects that you're offering them in their work of research and writing. What about potential translators or people who are interested in editing? What would you say to anyone who was interested in that line of work?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you raised that point. I think that specifically your audience could be relevant because they're both interested in academia and in science communication. So I think that's like kind of a good, there may be people who are listening who would be interested. I always say if you're talented and you're a brilliant editor or a brilliant translator, we will find work for you. We will. It may not be immediately, but we do work with a fairly large team of freelancers on a freelance basis, and we would be happy for people to reach out and be in touch with us. The requirements are that we do ask for individuals who have, you know, at least an MA in their specific field, so that they have, you know, a certain academic background, some experience in the field. And you know, on a very basic level, Daniel, I find that the best translators and editors that we work with, they're just great writers, you know. And there's a lot more to translation editing than just being a great writer. But it starts with that. If you love writing, if you enjoy writing, then doing translation editing can be a real, you know, just an enjoyable, you know, for some people we work with, it's a full-time job day and night. For some people, it's on, you know, on the weekends and in semester breaks where they have more time available. And you know, we have no minimum requirement in terms of how much people work with us. So, if everything I've said so far, you know, strikes a bell in your head and you say, oh, that's me, then, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out. We're always looking for talented individuals. We're growing, you know, by the month. And that requires, you know, keeping up and making sure that we have really talented individuals. Like I said, it's usually one of two types of people, either academics who have a strong penchant for language, or you know, very strong linguists who have a close ties to the academic world. Those are kind of the two personality types or backgrounds that we're looking for that I think can really contribute. And I like to think that we're really nice to work with as well. The same thing that I said before about the personal side when it comes to working with clients, same is true for translators and editors. We have an in-house team of in-house team that's reviewing and that's giving feedback to translators and editors, so you know how you're doing, you know if you need, you know, if there are places where you can improve or touch things up. So it's a learning experience as well. So that's one option. The other option is if there are scholars out there in the listening audience that say, well, I'd love to do that, but maybe I'm not there yet. We also have an internship program where you can kind of tag along with us for a few months virtually and, you know, come to attend the meetings and be an active member of our team and kind of learn the ropes and learn what academic translating and editing looks like and what the publishing process looks like. And we're happy to consider applications for our internship program as well. So I believe that if you go onto the website and you scroll down to the bottom in the footer, there is a button that says working with ALE. So if you follow that, you know, it should lead you to the promise line.
Well, that is academic experts. And if you need editing or like to edit, that's where you go. The CEO, founder, and director is Avi Stamen. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Avi. Goodbye.
Thanks so much, Daniel. It's been a real pleasure joining you today. And I hope that we get a chance to do this again soon.
Sounds great. And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye. And until next time here on Scholarly Communication.